The Conversation with Evan Walsh, part two.
So I suppose to condense what I was saying, so like, kind of like I was saying there, that because it wasn't in my life plan scheme to be sat with Muse and Lana Del Rey in a dressing room after a gig, it was more like a mad, random, you won't believe what happened to me on the summer holidays kind of experience. Then, oh, this is what life is going to be like. So when all that stuff, I think, yeah, because that was kind of the strangest it ever got, once that buzz kind of died down and it settled into more being a working band, that's more what I liked.
You didn't like the bells and whistles?
I didn't at all. No. I liked being the working touring club band, you know, playing clubs and colleges and you know, the odd Olympia style gig and things like that. And
Is it because you just didn't really believe it? Like the likes of these people coming, like you said already, like,
yeah, yeah.
You thought it was bullshit. Like these.
Kind of, yeah. Well, I mean, like, because again, massively flattered. You know, it's kind of like, oh, man, you know, gigantically flattered.
You have the best in the world telling you. Like, it must be hard to process that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Do you feel it's hard to separate, Evan, the feeling of everybody wants to be your friend or.
Well, you know, I think we were so. Nice. We were kind of so young that there was a bit of separation, that we were never going to be friends with these people anyway. You know, there was that kind of separation. We were kind of like the young lads and these were all adults. And so there was that divide existed there. But then also, it's also relative to your perception and your values as well. Because let's say an example being, that's a good example that, like, Muse, Lana Del Rey, personally, I couldn't name one song by either of them.
Okay.
I've never heard any, you know, I honest to God, just couldn't name one.
I've seen Muse now, they're pretty damn good. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and again, I'd say nothing against
it. Oh, I know, it's just not your thing.
It's just like, if it was Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, you know, name a Muse song,
I'd be
like,
friend. Call Gavin.
Yeah. And so, yeah, exactly.
Fair enough.
And same, like, you know, let's say people who would be more into, you know, people who were more into pop music who have been talking about, like, let's say we, you know, if I'm having a conversation with somebody, like, we met Ed Sheeran a couple of times. I couldn't give a damn about Ed Sheeran. I have no interest in anything he has done, is doing, or will ever do.
Okay.
And it's more just like,
it's not your thing, you know, from a personal music taste,
it just means nothing to me whatsoever. And me not liking him isn't going to hurt him.
No.
You know, he's all right. And so, like, met him a couple of times and it was just like meeting. It'd be like if you were, like, talking to someone who was, like, a golf fanatic and you met, like, a really famous golfer, but you didn't know who it was. And the golf fanatic's going, did you not know who that was? That's the biggest buzz ever. Yeah. And I'm going, was it?
Yeah.
You know, that's how I'd feel about Ed Sheeran or something like that. It'd be like, oh, that's that lad, he's famous and that's the thing.
Mm.
But the fact that through the band we got to meet the guys out of Dr. Feelgood, let's say, for example, Wilfred Johnson, the guitar player, and Dave Edmonds, who's a musician that is, like, I've often
that said, must have meant something to you from watching them VHS
exactly. So
that meant more.
So that would mean 100 million times. I mean, the universe compared to meeting Ed Sheeran.
Be the equivalent of us boys meeting Metallica.
Exactly. Yeah, you're literally in the room, you know, and you're, like, you know, and
it's your idol. That's your icon.
That's it. So it's like, you know, like, exactly. It'd be like, you know, you could meet, like, would you rather meet Ed Sheeran or Metallica? You know, it's that kind of thing where it's whatever, if you're a real fan and it means something to you. So it's like, because celebrity meant nothing to me, that wasn't enough of an impressive thing. The fact that we met Dave Edmonds and Wilco Johnson and people like that, that's the buzz that I still can't get my head around, that I'm still like, holy shit.
Yeah.
You know, and Jeff Beck and all people like that. But it was more like, I'd put Dave Edmonds on the tip top of meets for me, because I've often said, if I could be if I could, like, body hop, like, quantum leap the program, if I could quantum leap into somebody's, another musician and be, you know, another musician, it'd be Dave Edmonds, probably. You know, he's just my man in that kind of way.
Sure, icon.
Yeah, yeah. And we actually got to meet him when we did the third album in Rockfield Studios in Wales, which he helped actually set up.
Okay.
So all them big albums, Oasis and everything, had been done there. Yeah. He was the first guy to record in there. Him and the other guy kind of built the studio, and he had his first recorded his first album, he played all the instruments and made this thing himself, you know.
Wow.
And so meeting him and hanging out with him for a few hours, which he actually turned up at the end of the sessions for that album, that's, as you say, several universes and galaxies more value in that to me than meeting just famous people who I don't really know who they are, but I know I've heard of them.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of thing.
And to tell that to the general public is like, what, you met Ed Sheeran, you met this, that and the other,
doesn't
and
make any sense.
Someone who doesn't know who Dave Edmonds is, and you're like, that's probably the pinnacle of my
musical journey.
That's
as good as it'll ever get, is Dave Edmonds and Wilco Johnson and people like that. That's what it's all about.
It's absolutely incredible.
For me,
man.
Like, you know. And, I mean, we met Wilco Johnson and John B. Sparks, the bass player from Dr. Feelgood. So they jammed with us.
That's mad.
So they got up on stage with us and did a few Dr. Feelgood tunes with us. And it was in the Oysterfleet Hotel on Canvey Island, like in the middle of the...
That's where they were from.
We did a gig there. But it'd be like playing in, for anyone who is local, any listeners with any local knowledge, it'd be like playing in the Kilmore Hotel in Cavan or something like that. It's totally...
Just local...
There's places like that in every town in England and Ireland and Scotland and Wales. They've all got them.
Mm.
And so it's not like the Troubadour. It's not like anything like that. Yeah. It was like you could get good pub grub like downstairs. You know, that kind of...
Good food is fine.
Yeah. And it'd
get
be like...
Pint.
And you'd get like Sunday roast probably downstairs with creamy mash.
But that's all you needed.
More spuds for the boys there before the...
Oh, well, that was another thing. We pretty much scoured everywhere we went. Me and Pete, the bass player in particular, we were kind of thick as thieves and we just wanted steak and chips everywhere we went. We had no interest in exploring foreign food or expanding our minds or anything like that. It was like...
Well, for all our listeners that have travel plans, Evan has seen most of the world. So if you're looking for recommendations for steak and chips...
Yeah.
Feel free to hit him up.
Well, funny enough... because we did a lot of work in Japan as well, of course, over these years.
That's definitely something I want to get on to.
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely. We can do that now if you like. We can use... Steak and chips can be the segue because we used to do Japan a couple of times a year. Like, we had a kind of... It was the only country we had a bona fide hit single in.
I was going to say, what was that experience like to immerse yourself in the Japanese culture?
There's 20-something million
people in Tokyo.
Yes, or something mad like that.
It's something that a friend of mine had spoke about before in regards to our music. And I was thinking about, you know, you want to get seen or you want to get heard all over the world.
If
you focus on breaking one city, which what you guys done, which is fabulous in, say, Japan as a country, not necessarily one city.
They
talk to you guys big like ducks to water.
Yeah, big style. Yeah, so the Japan thing, I think we were kind of ideally made for Japan because
that punky kind of stuff.
It's the kind of punky
style.
Yeah, I was going to say
your style.
They love anything that's kind of
trendy, fashionable. They're huge into that,
and they love Western culture. They love British bands. They love that kind of... the fact we had the kind of we had the sort of mod image in the early days and, you know, kind of things like that. We kind of were into that sort of look.
Trying to look like
The Who and bands like that in the early days. And, you know, the Feel Goods and all that, we all had that kind of image. And so we had that image. We had the kind of... the long fringes, we had it all at that time. You know, I had the Bob Dylan, John Cooper Clarke, I was going for at that time as well. So we kind of had all the whole kind of gear on, the whole kit and caboodle. By pure fluke, it's exactly the kind of thing that a certain Japanese audience really takes to. And it's that energetic rock and roll. To them, because we're from this part of the world, that has a kind of a British slant. It's like, without getting controversial, to them, it's like The Who and The Kinks and The Stones and The Beatles. That's what that says to them.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where the attraction, I think, came in. And we had a hit single, by pure... We had a number 7 hit single in Japan. Because it was the only country we've actually had a hit single in. The rest of the time, it's just albums and stuff. Yeah. I think in the English singles chart, we got to 120 with one of the early singles.
Okay.
But there's no singles market in the UK really for that kind of thing.
Okay,
you know, there's
just
no
albums.
Yeah, it's just the album thing. And the singles market in the UK is like solid pop.
And
that's it.
Yeah.
You know. and there's no indie influence or no, no whatever in this English chart in the UK really. But we did have a number seven Japanese hit, and we had, that was the only place, because there's that kind of culture of real culture of respect, and everyone was really real culture, the whole culture founded on being really sound basically and being really nice. But there's also the fanaticism of
big time
waiting at the airport, waiting at the hotel, waiting at this,
was it just extreme?
So there was people wanting to get signed and pictures and things like that at every stage of your journey, you know what I mean, like your physical journey from the airport to the hotel to the gig back to the hotel. That, you know, people wanted souvenirs, they wanted photos. It was kind of the one country where that really, that cliche,
that pinch me moment of,
yeah, that cliche really existed. And it was like, it wasn't like, because everywhere you play, if there's people that are coming to see the gig, you might stop for a picture inside the venue or whatever, and that's all normal. But this was much more of a, like, this is the routine. We'll meet you at the airport. We'll follow you to the hotel. You know, it's kind of more, that's more kind of part of the thing for real, real hardcore fans.
Wow.
And did that end up being a problem when yourself and Pete would go for steak and chips?
Well, that's what I was going to say. So the obviously when you're on the other side of the world, that's when the culinary side of things is more challenging.
Yeah.
If you're like me and I'm very meat and two veg, you know, very
calf and dinner.
Very calf.
Spuds,
very
roasties.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Roasties and everything like that. That's what I'd be craving. If I was away, I'm not thinking
sushi.
I'm allergic to a lot of food as well, so it's like it doesn't, being adventurous in that way doesn't suit me. So our guy in Japan, we had a kind of a tour manager fella, and he alerted us to the fact that there's an Australian themed steakhouse chain in Japan called the Outback. Outback Steakhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we went for 10 days one time to do all these Japanese cities, and I found the Outback Steakhouse in every single city. Because our Japanese tour manager fella, he's a great friend of ours still to this day, he's a lovely fella, and he'd be on the money. So he had the address of the Outback Steakhouse before we'd even got there. We were on the bullet train going to the next city. Yeah. And he was like, Outback Steakhouse is, you know, that many, like, you know, it's 25 minutes from the hotel or whatever.
You're like, feed me.
Yeah, exactly.
And how long did it take the fans to figure out this now?
I don't think anybody copped us in that. No, I think because the weird thing in Japan as well
is that steak and chips follow them.
Yeah. So the funny thing
won't be fit to go back now after all the Japanese.
Yeah, exactly. And rice balls, actually, in all the train stations and news agents, they have little rice balls, little boiled rice kind of stuck together in a packet. And if I'd be dead if it wasn't for them. I wouldn't have had anything throughout the day.
Mm.
I was that young, it was the first time I ever had heartburn. I was in Japan.
You weren't drinking cans of cider.
The feeling.
Yeah, it was going like, God, I've had about 8 rice balls today.
Yeah.
But, what do you call it? So we were always kind of very homely in that way. It was all about familiarity and stuff like that, you know. So, I was saying, but the weird thing about Japan is that the gigs are all very early. The gigs are at like 6 o'clock in the evening.
Well, what's the atmosphere like at the gigs? Is it like
really high energy? Actually, once you get them going, because there is more of a culture, as you say, of respect and calmness.
Yeah.
But the weird thing is, when you're playing, they'll be moshing and going crazy with the rest of them.
But respectful moshing.
Yeah, and
dancing.
No aggression. I think in this part of the world, moshing comes with a bit of an aggressiveness, which can create a great atmosphere as long as it's contained.
Yeah, within the right reason.
Yes. You want a bit of aggression, you want a bit of, oh, Jesus, oh, it could go either way here.
It's impossible not to move to your music.
It's a good thing.
In fairness, some artist or whatever, it's literally impossible to.
Well, that's good to.
That's like good to know. Light of two left feet when it comes to that. But you gotta move.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's the reaction you want, really.
Of course, exactly.
So they'd have all the moshing and all the stuff, same as this part of the world, but the difference would be when you'd stop playing, they'd stop, and it'd be dead silent sometimes, but really respectful applause. And then, like, if we didn't play or talk, you could literally just go,
wow,
it'd be that quiet. You know, it wouldn't be like people going to the bar, people milling around, and all the kind of inherent rowdiness.
That's that you'd have here. Respectfulness that comes from their culture.
So you wouldn't have had that same kind of rowdiness and kind of people out for a night out, because it's all organised around the last train and bus home.
Yeah, everything's so efficient out there.
It's metronomically organised. So the last bus home or the last train home to wherever the suburbs are in this city are at, like, you know, 7:28.
Everything's
so it's all gone, and yeah. everybody's gone and out and home, and then we'd go to the Outback Steakhouse after.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. That's cool, man.
So it was weird. It was kind of backwards, because you're like, you're doing the gig, you're like thinking, geez, I've only just had me lunch and the gig's nearly, we're on in like 2 hours. So then your day is kind of topsy-turvy, you know.
And was it big arenas out there, or was it, did I see
no, it was
festivals?
Yeah, we would have done Fuji Rock Festival. What was the other one? Asagiri Jam was another festival we did.
They're huge crowds.
Yeah, massive, yeah.
Fuji Rock, I think. Did Dermot Kennedy play that last year?
He probably did.
Oh, he probably
did. And anybody that's kind of doing well like that, it'll kind of come into the orbit of Fuji Rock and bits and bobs. But what was I going to say? Yeah, and Asagiri Jam was another good one. So, like, we would have done them, and then our own gigs would have been, like, what they would have considered clubs, like, big clubs. So, like, let's say we do two nights in Tokyo, and there might have been 800 people each night, that kind of thing.
Mm.
So most of the venues, you're talking 1,000 people max. You know what I mean? Yeah, I'd say probably it's like that kind of level still.
It's a lot.
Yeah. We would have done maybe 5 or 6 cities, kind of conservative estimate. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
When we'd go over there, we'd go over for 10 days and you'd kind of maybe... Well, maybe you'd do more than that. But yeah, I suppose you'd have promo days as well. You wouldn't be gigging every day. You'd have a day of just doing interviews.
And Japanese television.
Yeah, oh, we did...
that would have been good.
We did Japanese telly with Kiss.
No way.
Yeah, which is really funny. We were on a programme called Music Station, which is like the Japanese Jules Holland, basically.
Okay.
But because it's Japanese telly, it's lit like it's morning TV.
Okay.
It's like the Jules Holland of Japan, but it looks more like Sunday brunch.
Ireland
AM. Like kind of morning TV. It's got that bright, sunny kind of vibe to it.
Sunglasses definitely needed.
Yeah, a sparkle
from Kiss then.
Well, honest to God. So we did this thing, and we didn't know, obviously, who was going to be on. But there was all the acts were being introduced at the start. It was like stars in their eyes. It was like you come out through the smoke kind of thing. And so the presenter would be talking to me in Japanese, and then he'd say, so-and-so's going to be on, and this Japanese person come out through the smoke, and another Japanese band. We were on with a Japanese boy band, a boy band and girl band, and the boy band had like 10 fellas in it. And then there was a Japanese girl band called like J42, and we were like, why are they called J42? And it was because there were 42 girls in the band.
Ah, no.
So that was kind of mad. And
lucky JJ72 hadn't got 72 members.
Yeah, good job. And the 101ers didn't have, But it was like 42 young ones in this band that would do this massive choreographed dance routine. And I don't even think they were singing. I think that was just the gimmick. Was just look at all these women doing this choreographed dance routine. And I think there was an age cap, as in when one member hit 25, she was out.
You're out.
And another one was brought in.
Leonardo DiCaprio must have been the manager of that band.
must have been. Yeah.
In his side time.
Yeah. That was. He took his cue from J42. All right, but. So that was a way of pop music, Svengali attitude we hadn't encountered before.
Yeah.
But so we were coming up, we'd all go up these stairs and appear through the smoke sort of thing. So there was all the Japanese acts, you know, whoever was doing this, whoever was doing that. And then we came through the smoke, and then behind us came Kiss, which was really funny because the lads were in their full... gear. And we met them in the full gear and you know their platforms really were a couple of feet off the ground and full makeup, full shebang, you know, and that was the only time we had any interaction with them, you know.
Yeah.
And because obviously they were going along because they were the big act, they were saying hello to everybody else that was on it, and so Gene Simmons was like, oh, you guys, oh, Irish, okay, all that sort of stuff. And not a conversation or anything like that, just a kind of a hello sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah,
but he
yeah.
was like, "Yous aren't Japanese, where are you from?" kind of thing.
Yeah.
And what was I going to say?
Gene Simmons was like, "Where's good for steak and chips?"
Yeah, 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 yeah. Exactly, exactly. Yeah. If it's Western dining you're after, I'm your man. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, so we'd had some great times in Japan, experiences. Yeah. And so we did those, yeah, did a couple of TV things like that. And everybody, it was always fantastic. Like, we had a fantastic Japanese label, as in the people working.
When you were out there.
Yeah, were all really brilliant people.
Did you do any other countries out there in Asia? Or was it?
We did Hong Kong once, okay. And that was like a festival called Clock and Flap, I think it was called.
Okay.
And another weird thing about that was it turned out that the festival, the word Clock and Flap, doesn't mean anything. It's a made up word, but it's what people on that part of the world would think a Western word sounds like, in the way, like an English word. So in the way that,
what would it watch?
So in the way that we might have a perception of like Chinese or Japanese without knowing how to speak
I
it.
I get you, yeah.
So their perception of English or European languages would be like clock and flap. Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, and part of the process, the interview process, we were doing promo before we went on stage, and everybody on the bill had to come up with a definition for the word clock and flap, what they thought the word clock and flap could potentially mean.
Mm.
God knows what we said, it's lost to the mist of time. But so we did that in Hong Kong. And
did you ever go down around Australia?
Once. We did a really punishing regime one time where we went to Japan and did one festival, then flew the next day to Australia via Hong Kong, did 3 or 4 gigs in Australia, and then flew back to Japan, did another festival
on the way
and
home.
Then went home.
that was a test, like Austin.
Yeah.
So that was a week's sleep needed after that.
Yeah, and definitely a week's sleep I didn't get. That was the one time, I never had jet lag, but that one time I was fucked with the jet lag. It was really bad.
That's completely different time zones, isn't it? Like even just that short flight.
Upside down or right side up. Or
exactly. Exactly.
You're coming even it's long from Tokyo or Japan to Australia.
Yeah.
Already, yeah. You're in that hemisphere, but it's still
you're going really long haul
flights. I remember I watched the Office for the first time on that on that flight, the English Office.
So then, what year then did it all come to a halt?
To a halt. Well, it was really 2018. We decided to be winding it down. Throughout 2017, we were thinking of it. We put our third album out and all that, but the kind of wind was going out of the sails a wee bit just because we've been at it for so long. And unless there was unless you had a really renewed sense of direction, unless you really were like, well, we really are, you know, we're 3 albums in, we've toured it, it did okay, we kind of had settled into our kind of little groove. As I say, we did Japan, we did, you know, did all American tour. We did all the bits. And I suppose when all that came to, that the album cycle, as they call it, came to an end, which is like 18 months, we'd been thinking about it as we were on tour, because it was getting punishing being on the road for that many years without any kind of break, really.
Mm. Especially in your formative years.
In formative years, and we were formed doing that, if you know what I mean. So we did have, and we had, I mean, we weren't the hardest working band in show business, but we were pretty hard working, and we do like a couple of hundred gigs a year, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh man, that's work.
Like, yeah. That's work. And we weren't like, it wasn't like, oh, I haven't seen home in months. We were coming and going a lot and all that, and it was good, but there was kind of a thing of like, if the band was to keep going and have any more sort of head of steam in it, there'd need to be some sort of creative
overhaul, like a
creative overhaul, as in like, you know, renewed sense of direction and renewed sense of, well, this is the next step, this is where we want to go. And we probably just didn't all feel the same about it, you know, as in like, let's say, you know, Josh the guitar player, he's still making music, which would be very different from the Stripes music. He was moving in his own direction, which is fair enough for him, and I think he needed to go and do that, you know, that kind of thing. And I think there's a little bit of the last Stripes album, me and Pete, the bass player, did half of it, and Josh wrote the other half of it. And Josh written a lot of songs before that, for the band, but it was a little bit like, you know, half of our thing and half of his thing.
Yeah.
You know, because we were the two writing camps and they weren't 100 million miles apart, but you could see how...
The separations and themes.
You could see how another album, you could try and go in to make a fourth album and...
Different directions.
The directions would have gotten even more starkly different. Mm. I think, you know, me and Pete, our stuff was kind of, we were carrying on that sort of... Well, we were very influenced by Stiff Records, this, again, like kind of punk new wave label that had a lot of stuff, British acts in the 70s, late 70s and 80s. And we were really kind of on the Stiff Records vibe. Josh is probably moving into his own vibe, which I'd probably leave it best up to him to describe it. But, you know, I think you can only listen to, you could listen to what we're up to now. I'm doing this and Josh is doing his thing. You could just listen to what we're up to now and you kind of get a bit of a picture of the direction.
One party
was going in one direction, the other direction. And it wasn't... before, I was kind of like... Just kind of, again, like having that bit of distance, as in like table to look at the situation that we kind of practiced a lot. I think it's kind of like, you know, we could call it now and it'd kind of end pretty well. You know what I mean?
If there was going to be a conflict of interest in the
And instead of
take
it...
Take the good out of it.
Yeah, instead of it becoming a thing where people go more and more off in different directions and it comes to blows or comes to the classic musical differences break up in the studio, you know, instead of having things break down, you know, you know, we kind of had already... had a rocky experience on the second album because there was a lot of label interference and a lot of stuff like that going on. And, you know, I'm not fond of that album, that second album. So it's like, you know, because it kind of, to me, it feels like it's neither one thing nor another. And it's kind of half, you know what I mean?
Well, they're putting your twist on it.
Yeah, it's kind of half. Like,
oh, this is what you want me to play. So instead of being
Evan
the creator, it was nearly like Evan the hired gun for his own band.
Well, kind of, yeah. And we were all, four of us were hired guns for the band that we'd started. You know, that kind of thing?
Yeah,
so it was a bit kind of like, you know, I remember there was, you know, comments from on high about, you know, every little minute detail was under scrutiny, which it wasn't like that for the other two albums.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it just wasn't the buzz really that we had gone into it for. And obviously Josh was writing the songs at that time. Pete had written a few, but the majority of the strain was put on Josh to meet those people's expectations.
From the labels.
So they kind of tried to divide and conquer a little bit in that sense. I think that's the game the label would play. And, you know, we came out to the side of it, which is great. And then the third album, we kind of got back to doing our own thing. But you kind of see on the last time, it's kind of like more like ourselves, but also a bit like it was more of a last hurrah than it was a rejuvenated thing.
Yeah.
It was more like, well, the last album was such a balls. We have to try and, we'll have to band together. And we went from, we basically went from Please Please Me to Abbey Road in three albums. Or Get Back in three albums. You know what I mean? That it's like, you know, you kind of go to whatever that particular project's lifespan. It just kind of felt like we were spent collaborating in that way. You know what I mean? It was kind of like, and when you've been doing it with the same people since you were literally
12,
a gossin, literally a child.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit weird.
You've grown with these guys and then everybody has their own direction or their own feelings.
Yeah, and somebody else thinks, oh, I wouldn't mind. Like, some of the boys aren't in the music business at all anymore. And, you know, people start thinking, oh, wouldn't mind going off and doing this and wouldn't mind going off and doing that.
The movies.
Oh, yeah, Rocket Man. Yeah. That was our kind of last hurrah, really.
Yeah.
There was the last hurrah in the studio was the third album. And it was a bit like, I think it was nearly like the last album was such a balls. We have to kind of get back to ourselves and do one again that's more about what we're about.
Mm.
And it was kind of a compromise in a nice way of what everybody was at. And it was kind of like, well, if this album really gels and we really are feeling it and we're thinking, fuck yeah, we could make 10 more albums like this, let's go for it, let's do it. But we kind of had reached the end of the 18 months of touring it and we were a bit like, we've kind of done it.
Yeah.
That's kind of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We've kind of done all we can do with this, really. And any change, any big creative change that would need to take place, as you say, you couldn't get everybody would be in a different camp about that anyway.
Mm.
So we kind of decided we were going to break up, and then did Rocket Man kind of as a farewell, as a one last hurrah, yeah. Because when are you going to be asked to be in a fucking movie? Like, never. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So because of the Elton John connection with us, and Elton was always very great, very good to us in that way. You know, whenever we had any interaction with him, he was really supportive and all that sort of stuff. And so we were delighted. We were thrilled to get the finger pointed at us to say maybe yous could be the 60s band in the first bit of Rocket Man when he's touring with the soul group in the, you know, back in the soul singers. Yeah.
I watched it today actually.
That was one of my favorite experiences of the whole band, actually, was doing that, because I was always fascinated with movies and music movies in particular. Like, again, same way as like me saying like the Beatles movies and the Monkees and all that was like my formative childhood thing about bands. I still have that now. I'm still obsessed with like rock and roll movies. I think they're a huge interest of mine.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's loads of brilliant ones, loads of really gritty ones from down the years and all that. But it was kind of like, oh God, we get to even do our little moment like that. Yeah. You know, get to do the little...
Well, it was a nice thing to see.
The little kind of bit in the movie kind of thing. You know, it was great.
And it was a nice way to maybe finish that chapter off.
Yeah. And funny enough... another big buzz was that it was directed by a guy called Dexter Fletcher, who's the great director, but he's also one of the kids from Bugsy Malone.
No way.
You know, Babyface in the film Bugsy Malone.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're going, give this to Babyface, give this to Babyface. The little kid that gets... Yeah. That's him. He directed Rocket Man.
Jesus.
So that was the buzz as well. Yeah. So that's like, jeez, I've seen you when I was a kid on the telly. How many Bank Holiday Mondays did I see him on telly? And now he's like, you know... Yeah. You're like working with him in a film, he's like getting you to do like mime to this song.
Yeah, and Dr. Feelgood, like you said, you used to watch that and you got to do
so there's a lot of them kind of weird little moments of like
full circle moments.
And that's kind of the biggest nearly kick of it was like, it's like us, these fucking shit kicking lads, just ended up in this situation in this world. Where it's like, oh fuck, that's the letter of that band that we like, and that's the letter. So it was nice like that, you know.
So then the new chapter started then.
Yeah. So post-COVID really is the kind of Savage Hearts thing really coming about.
You took a bit of time out.
Yeah, well, myself and some of the other lads from the Strikes, we collaborated on a few bits and bobs, a few tracks and things like that. And, you know, the COVID time, we released them during COVID and it was kind of like... It was a funny time really for everybody you know, and everybody's whole lives got turned... inside out and upside down. Yeah. So there was that kind of horrible, you know, that kind of horrible sort of like nothing time.
Unknown time.
Scary, nothing time. So after being through a couple of years with that, and then we'd done a few bits together, me and the other Stripes lads, when we got to the end of that time, kind of felt like that project belonged in that time. And the other lads also, we all had, again, we were just kind of thinking, some of us wanted to take time out. You know, some of the lads are thinking about, you know, career change, all that sort of stuff. So like, you know, things that come about in life as well, you know, at that sort of stage.
Life terms and life gets in the way.
Yeah. There was a good bit of that coming into it. There was a good bit of that. So like when you get to after COVID then, like 2022, I had a load of demos basically done, just ideas for songs, and I'd kind of done my first bit of... I'd done little bits and bobs of writing for the Stripes, more musical ideas than lyrics or anything like that. And myself and Pete had collaborated on about half of the last album. And so there was like a load of musical ideas basically that I had that I'd never finished off.
Yeah.
And I basically whacked them all down, all the different ideas, all the riffs, all the bits that when I was noodling around with the guitar or the bass or whatever.
Yeah.
And ended up having, you know, finished them off myself, you know. Some of them I just kind of turned into fully fledged songs, and some of them I kind of started collaborating with pals basically from other bands. So because we were in the Stripes for them years, you're locked into a dynamic really where you're not going to go off and collaborate with people in other bands necessarily you know, for the main project.
Yes, yes.
So, like, there's a band, a couple of great bands, fantastic bands that we toured with. Raglans were one, if you ever heard of Raglans, okay. And the Mighty Steph, if you ever heard of them.
Right.
We would have toured with them a lot during the Stripes, and, you know, we would have played in Dublin together in the early days, and then when we went on tour, we would have brought them out to open for us, and there would have been all that sort of stuff. We became really close mates anyway with the lads in those bands over the years. And two of the guys, the main songwriters in both those bands, Stephen Murphy from the Mighty Steph and Steve Kelly from Raglans, are two really good chums.
Mm.
And me and Steve ended up collaborating. He lives in Spain, but I started sending the ideas over to him, and I'd never done that before with someone who was totally outside of that Stripes camp, and actually getting really some brilliant
work together. But it was starting to click.
As in getting some really exciting work done. As in, like, I was really starting to go, geez, these ideas that I've had for ages that could never find a home for them or could never... And I had a very kind of, like, I still had a lot of energy in my head for band stuff rolling around of, like, you know, like, as I say, being influenced by a lot of the kind of contemporary garage rock and psych rock and all that that's happening in America at the moment, like Ty Segall and King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard and the OCs and Naked Giants, Nude Party, loads of them bands. There's a huge, brilliant scene in America at the minute of these brilliant kind of garage punk psych.
It's coming back.
Kind of bands. Yeah, it's brilliant, really, really vibrant scene. And I started getting really into that stuff and really excited by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of thinking, fuck, that's the kind of thing now that I'm not in a band.
Mm.
That's the kind of stuff I'm really getting off on at the minute.
That's what I'm feeling. This is where I want to go with
I'm getting off on that, and the idea of kind of merging those contemporary influences with the other influences that I've had my whole life.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of working it all in there. So collaborating with Steve and then collaborating with Steph, the Mighty Steph, you know, I started writing with both the lads, you know, sending ideas back and forth because we're all living in different places. And it was a really nice buzz and a very different buzz. And it was that kind of thing of bringing in different influences that even things that, like, maybe, let's say, you know, like when you're in a band, like the Stripes, let's say it was a very much a democratic thing. So it ends up being like a quarter of the influence ends up kind of being mine. And, you know, we're all kind of, but like,
you had your freedom back.
And it's kind of, it's the sum of its parts that makes it. So now this is kind of like, you know, even if in the Stripes, if the Stripes had been a dictatorship, and I had been the dictator, it probably wouldn't have sounded a million miles away from the Savage Arts. Where, like, it's not 100 million miles removed from the Stripes at all, but it's probably just in a slightly different...
Mm.
It's in the same housing estate as the Stripes. It just doesn't live at the same address.
It's at the bottom of the road.
Yeah. Where, like, there's the energy and the, you know, like, the harmonica.
It's definitely there, man.
You know, the kind of blues influence and all that sort of
stuff. Harmonica.
Yeah.
And even what she's done with Big Hunk of Love.
Oh yeah, you know, get that a bit of a drive, and those kind of covers, EPs, and all that. Like, we just whacked them up because, like, that was kind of getting the band together, and I was kind of trying to get a lineup happening, and just demoing at home and just messing around and just doing covers and stuff for the crack. So
you produced a lot of it then, did you?
Yeah, well, some of those cover things, that's just me playing all the instruments, and I just layered them up in the room, in the bedroom, and kind of did this kind of psychobilly, weird, demented singing over it. And you know, kind of like, I suppose, how if I had been maybe the dictator of the Stripes, that's how full throttle I would have liked it to have gone.
Would have taken it,
you know what I mean,
level.
But obviously other people have other ideas, and it ends up being a kind of a more of a democratic kind of blend of influences. So, but that kind of more full throttle meathead garage vibe is more my kind of style. You know, like with the single with Gang War and Speed Kills and all that, it's kind of, I think Gang War in particular, it kind of brings it into that more contemporary garage rock, Ty Segall kind of influence. You know, I was kind of coming, you know, that's kind of more what, and even people have very flatteringly likened it to the Stranglers, which is that kind of, you know, I'd love that kind of vibe as well, you know, so it's just more what comes naturally to me. And again, no more than the early Stripes days, I'm just literally doing it because I want to do it. Mm. No other reason than that. It's that thing of, like, you know.
Is it fun again for you?
Great fun. Absolutely brilliant fun. Yeah. And, like, the band, the lineup that we have at the moment is brilliant. Like, you know, it's all a lot of local fellas, actually, from Roy Cavan and stuff like
Terry
that.
Terry Brady?
Yeah, Terry played a fantastic harmonica player. And really talented all rounder, I'd say. Yeah, but he's an extraordinary harmonica player, actually. Yeah. He's really played with Terry in a couple of things.
It brings a lot to your music, like Gang Wars, it's full throttle.
Yeah. And that's always kind of been my sort of I've always kind of swung in the direction of that, you know. And like I'd have been big into bands like there's a band called the Jim Jones Review, who were like kind of like they were late 2010s, early 2010s, they were around, and they were like a kind of a sort of psycho fuzzed up, you know, full throttle version of like even more full throttle than it already was, like 50s rock and roll. Like it'd be like taking Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis, which is already full throttle,
yeah,
you know, burn your house down kind
definitely,
of stuff,
yeah,
and stuff that got me going. But they took it and did it in that kind of modern garage rock revival
distortion,
ramped up the distortion because the technology moves on,
yeah.
So they kind of did it like it would be like, who would you say it'd be like just that, like a real fuzzed up anarchic punk band,
yeah,
playing Little Richard style rock and roll. So was big, very, very influenced by that kind of stuff, yeah. You know, and that kind of
comes across,
yeah, that kind of sums up what a lot of this kind of project was, even the songs were born out of. And now there's other, as stuff comes out, there's other influences in there, but that initial burst of the first single and all that, that's very much the side of it that's being lent into at the minute.
We look forward to see the journey that Savage Heart is going on.
Yeah, hopefully now it'll be a fun one now. That's the main thing about it, is because the Stripes, we've been through all the different phases that a lot of bands that get signed go through in a very short space of time. So I kind of have no.
You're back on the wave and just see where it goes.
I'm back on the wave of just doing it because I want to do it, and it's the kind of thing of like, you know, I'm not thinking, oh, I got to get back up there and I got to get back doing this, I got to get back doing that. I just want to do it.
Just want to do it.
And I just want to be in a band and play gigs and be in a good band and play songs you like playing, release songs you like, you know, produce music, you know, get more into the production side as well, and really, really produce music that you love, you know, that you're really, really thrilled to bits with, like, you know, I actually love what I'm producing, and, you know, this is the kind of stuff that I'm completely, completely want to be doing, and I'm just putting it out there, and if you like it, that's fantastic. You know, see you at the gigs if you like it. You know, that kind of
thing. Definitely, that's awesome. You know? Like, isn't it?
It's
cool.
But hey, it's just doing your own thing, doing what you want to do.
Yeah. And it's like, if you want to come and enjoy it, I'm the door's open, but it's kind of just there to be enjoyed, you know, for whatever.
It's far better having those out than having them on a hard drive.
Exactly. Yeah, and already the Gang War thing, it's the way it's been received, just on the little kind of indie level. It's been fantastic. I've been buzzing, you know, and I can very candidly say by the end of the Stripes, I wasn't buzzing, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
You needed that time out.
You weren't buzzing about it. You were just relieved. It was just kind of like, you know, a release of pressure as opposed to a great buzz, you know, whereas even this now, you know, working with Richard and the Blowtorch kind of setup and, you know, like doing the little run of vinyls and doing the little, you know, and you're kind of, you're back to, it's back like when we did the first Stripes EP and we were just doing it for the Larry of it, as they say. You know, it was just purely about that and purely about the buzz, and fuck, I'm really happy with how that's turned out, and the launch gig goes great and do this, and, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, get back just on the kind of gigging kind of thing, you know.
What's coming? Is there much stuff coming this year? Is C Sessions?
We're confirmed for C Sessions and getting out and about, a couple of gigs in the pipeline for Dublin, you know, like as in the Dublin indie scene. And we could be heading abroad. We could be doing a few bits and bobs like that, but we'll have to see how things pan out exactly.
Cool.
You know, but there's lots of stuff in the pipeline. And I think the thing as well, because we're in total control of this kind of thing, I'd like to be releasing things very frequently.
Okay.
You know, releasing singles at a good going rate.
Right, okay.
You know, that kind of thing. So, like, you know, back in the kind of thing, because again, I come from that obsession of, you know, obsessed with The Who and those kind of bands, that in their initial era, they were like, every like 3 or 4 months, there was a new thing, there was a new single. So, like, you know, if you can do that yourself, why not? You know,
those
I'm not.
Albums, yeah, those, exactly. Artists, their output of work was phenomenal.
Yeah, exactly. Especially at that time, because they were under so much pressure to do it and they were contractually obliged to do it. But they managed to, you know, the industry back then was that way. And I think Also, though, in the contemporary sense, you have people like Ty Segall and King Gizzard and all those bands who are really, I'm really so into that scene, and they'll release 4 albums in a year, more. You know what I mean? Like, they just have that kind of freewheeling indie punk garage wave going on, where there'll be just random singles and EPs. That's and right. I think King Gizzard released 6 albums in 1 year or something like that. They all were interconnected in some way, but it was like part of a bigger project. But they still kind of have that unconventional. It's not like, you know, the one album every 5 years has to be an event. It's just like more, I think this is more more so than the Stripes times. This is, I'm more engaged, without sounding bullshitty, the Savage Hearts is more me engaging on an artistic level, the kind of self-expression, you know, it's like more musical self-expression on my part.
Yeah.
Whereas the Stripes was more of an organic band.
I get you.
Vibe.
Whereas this is the Evan Walsh endeavor.
Yeah, and it's more
of your musical influences.
Yeah, and
out.
More developed because you're older and you have more idea, more of a.
Well, you have a wealth of experience.
Oh, yeah, and more of an idea of what you'd like to do as well. Where I think.
And you've changed instrument.
Yeah, swapped over the bass. Yeah. Because I actually tried being the drummer at the start of this, and I kind of figured out that you couldn't lead from the back, you know. It was like trying to get other lads to get, trying to explain to everybody it's supposed to sound like X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
When you're leading from the back, it just didn't work. I tried it for a wee while, and I've always wanted to be the bass player as well. I've been, you know, loved being the drummer and loved and all that, but I'm a bass obsessive, like kind of John Entwistle and people like that. I also, when I was a teenager, was trying to learn to play like him and trying to do all that, you know, because it really was a 24/7 obsession of wanting to be immersed in that kind of thing. So, you know, if I can kind of take things a bit easier and play the bass for a wee while, that's just a bit of fun, you know. It's a good way to do it.
Yeah, it looked like you enjoyed yourself at the launch party.
Yeah. And it's kind of getting into that kind of groove, which is good, you know. And even with the band now, like the sax in the band these days, and so it's kind of like it's a much broader thing, because as I said, Stripes is more set in its ways of, well, this is the band and this is how it functions. Everyone has their little dynamic role, so we have like the sax and Terry on the harmonica, he's, you know, Eugenio on the sax as well. Everybody, all the lads that are in the band are fantastic. Dara on lead guitar, vocals, and Emil on drums, they're all exceptionally talented fellas. But like the sax brings such a different colour to it, because I've always had that 50s rock and roll
little. You can hear it. Like,
you can hear the
from
influence.
From the second it's unbelievable.
So, like, I've kind of always wanted that kind of Jerry Lee Lewis 50s rock and roll, you know, as you say, burn the house down kind of vibe.
Wow. I have to ask you then about the Eddie Cruiser.
Oh, yeah. So that was kind of just a bit of crack, really. This is kind of like a little kind of thing that goes along with the Savage Hearts, like a little mascot kind of guy, Eddie Cruiser. And now that came about because there is, shrouded in mystery, and I'm actually deadly serious, there is an Elvis impersonator hailing from Cavan. I won't divulge his real identity, but when he has impersonated Elvis on occasion, he's gone by the name of Eddie Cruiser.
Okay.
And I just thought, well, if you're going to have a band mascot, it might as well be the Elvis impersonator from Cavan.
Why not?
That kind of suits.
That's incredible.
That kind of sums up my kind of vibe. So you have that. You have this kind of mysterious, kind of menacing guy who's kind of like the band's kind of avatar figure, and he crops up in some of the songs as well.
Yes. You know, and the artwork.
Yeah. So some of the songs that are unreleased at the minute have Eddie Cruiser does come in and out of the lyrical themes.
Right. He's going to follow on the journey.
Yeah. And he's just this guy who kind of lives in the band's little orbit, and this kind of teddy boy, you know, ageless, you know.
Got his hair slicked back. He's got his shirt ready. He's getting
an iron
for Saturday night. He's going to tear the house down.
Yeah, exactly. But he's living it up in Cavan, just living the rock and roll Elvis teddy boy fantasy.
Sounds good.
Well, we're going to try and wrap it up.
Yep,
Evan, absolutely. And it's been an absolute pleasure. But before you go, we do have some more questions.
All right,
one of them being, what is that sound to you when you think of your perfect sound?
Yeah,
that you aspire.
I
know you've probably answered it throughout the podcast.
Well, I could probably, if I was to succinctly describe it, it's like, my kind of thing is really like, I suppose, let me just put this together. You've got a kind of a, I like there's a kind of a, I suppose actually the most kind of, or one of the best examples of production that I've really, like a specific sound that I've really thought, holy shit, like that's, if I could be inside that sound,
yeah.
You know, I'd be happy out if I could create something that was like that. There's a band called The Move,
okay,
which is Roy Wood, who later wrote Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day. Before he was with Wizard, before he did that,
yeah.
He was in this kind of late 60s, early 70s, psychedelic kind of rock, kind of like psychedelic meets heavy rock meets 50s rock and roll revival band called The Move.
Okay.
And they were kind of an underground band in that sort of era. And they have an album called Looking On, and it's like this, the production is like, it's like a wrecking ball. It's like really like, it's like 50s rock and roll riffs being played like this with this real harsh metallic lumbering, it's like heavy machinery.
Okay.
It's like if I imagine it, it feels like heavy grinding, clanking machinery churning out this kind of mangled, kind of psychedelic tinged version of like primal rock and roll, basically.
Are you? It sounds similar to what you're bringing. To.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's the influence there. Yeah, you know, yeah, that's kind of it, really.
And that's incredible.
Yeah. And that's a huge. Roy Wood's music in general is a huge, huge kind of.
That's a cool answer.
Yeah, your question on the band lineup.
Yeah.
Oh right, yeah.
Oh yeah. So we've done this with a few guests. So if you had the power to form a 4-piece band.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Dead or alive, to make an album that's going to blow the world out of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Who's the four guys?
I could say Roger Daltrey, Pete Townsend, John Entwistle, Keith Moon.
Oh, man. What an eclectic mix.
No.
Wow.
No, you could have... Let me think about that. Well, I would have John Entwistle on bass. let me think now. I'll try and vary it up a bit.
No, just go for it.
Lee Brillo from Dr. Feelgood, front man. He's my favourite front man, I think. We'll go Jeff Beck on guitar in his Yardbirds.
Nice.
Yardbirds baby. Pomp. Yeah, we'll go John Entwistle on bass. And then drums, you see, you could go Keith Moon, but you've already got John Entwistle in there from The Who, so you've kind of got a bit of a... I'll try and vary it up a bit. Let me have a think about that for a second. I'll have Pete Thomas, who's the drummer from Elvis Costello's band. No, sorry, I'm going to change that answer.
Okay.
I'm going to have a fella called Terry Williams, who's the drummer in Rockpile, Dave Edmunds band. He's an absolutely sensational drummer. So that'd be my tour there.
That's the album that's going to blow the world out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that would be absolutely...
It'd blow the garage out of it, blow the garage doors off, anyway.
Yeah, man.
Blow the roller door off.
Yeah.
Well, man, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And,
no problem at all.
We have this single from Evan, and we're going to do a competition, and we might get Evan to maybe sign it, and we'll get a competition going, and it's an absolute banger of a song, guys. Check it out. Evan has some great social media too. Check him out, Savage Hearts. I was watching it earlier today, actually, footage of the launch show. Like, it's...
Oh, thanks very much.
I'm really looking forward to checking you guys out.
Yeah, I'm sure hopefully we'll have you along.
Yeah, definitely.
For anyone that's at Tea Sessions or will be in town for any of the gigs,
make sure
you make your way along. You surely won't regret it.
Yeah, there'll be more gigs, plenty more gigs being announced on social media and stuff as the year goes on. So,
stay tuned as the old saying goes.
Evan, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks very much, man.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all for this week's episode on That Sound Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Evan Walsh as much as we did.
Yeah, it was brilliant to have Evan here. Evan has done things that people only dream about doing. Evan has done it all at such a young age as well. Touring America, touring Canada, Japan, mixing with the biggest artists in the world, you know, and such a down-to-earth guy. Again, thanks to Evan for coming down, having the conversation with us. We also have Evan's new single, Gang War, on vinyl that we're going to do a competition. So keep an eye on our socials and we'll be dropping that competition soon. We hope to catch you on the next one.
Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.